from pregnancy examinations, prenatal care, not having this as routine tests, but in the light of the court rulings that we have in this issue, this is very difficult because prenatal care is no longer financed if you do not get at least three ultrasounds. And ultrasound is always the entrance, the first point when genetic diagnosis may be established. There are a lot of fundamental court rulings where doctors, for example, have to pay lifelong alimony for children who have genetic diseases which could be diagnosed, could have been diagnosed during the pregnancy. So these are the legal framework conditions under which we're operating. I have a suggestion regarding terminology and definition of our terminology that we use. We have been talking about diagnosis or diagnostics, and I think we should really be careful of not mixing our terms. Genetic tests, attributing something to genetics tests, which isn't part of genetic tests, because 15 years ago, we had a human being in front of us, but the results of the examinations were never diagnosis or diagnostics. It was a diagnosis, but not diagnostics. And genetic tests have nothing to do with this. They're not even a. They are perhaps a result with which a diagnosis could be correlated. So, using genetic tests, we can make probability statements. Genetic tests serve to class for classification of statistical populations, and probability statements can be made. And this then is attributed to the individuals. For example, you have a 5% or 1% probability, and this has nothing to do with diagnostics. So, I would really be careful. Because and diagnostics might not even be the right word for what we're talking about here. Question without microphone, the interpreter can't hear. Just a very brief comment on what you just said about the catalogues that the doctors make available. I'm missing one element in this entire debate. If it's just the medical community, the medical experts, genetic experts, and parents are involved in the discussion, perhaps it would also be good to bring across the information that is also very good and very rewarding to work with disabled children. And if you only see these horrible images, this really distorts reality and the perspective, because I really can't understand how a doctor manages to show parents these images. There should be really be a proposal or something like that positive images of disabled children, perhaps film material, should be shown to the parents of what's possible pedagogically regarding therapy for these children, because otherwise the image is really distorted, and I think that this is catastrophic and degrading too. And that would be a demand, saying that we have to get away from only listening to those who have no experience with disabled children. We have one office in Munich where people try to bring this a little closer to reality, the reality of disabled children. But if you just show parents this atlas, well, there are always the worst symptoms being shown. It's such a shock to people. And it's the doctor who shows them these images. So they assume that this is true and this is going to be the case. And they don't want to give birth to a monster, and of course, then they want to have an abortion. And this is, I think, a lot, is as much too quick. Of course, I can't tell a woman you have to give birth to a disabled child. I can't do that. But if she sees the people, for example, a child with Down syndrome, it's something completely different from an image of a child with Down syndrome is completely different from a living child with Down syndrome that you meet. And there are already a lot of people available who work in this field. I mean, basically, you just give the woman a toothbrush, send her to the clinic, and let her have an abortion. And she's not told that this process takes 3 days and how painful this process is. She just thinks that by magic, this fetus will just disappear from her body, and they're often psychological problems. They need psychological advice. They have empty cradle groups, something like that. And they have the impression that they've killed their own child. And you have to be honest about this. If you take a child out of the womb in the 28th week, this is not just a cell lump anymore. I think the scandal is that women, as soon as they undergo tests, I think you can do this after 4 weeks already, they'll have to justify themselves that they do not want to have the child. But as soon as they have a diagnosis that is not socially desirable, then it's totally legitimate. And I think that is the actual scandal.
In other words, they have to justify wanting the child, giving birth to the child. In other words, the woman always has to justify whatever it is that she does. There are studies which show that during the process of examination, the child is beginning to develop. So, in other words, that is the first point in time in many cases where suddenly there is an understanding on the part of the woman that life is beginning. So before that, possibly she was very distant, felt very distant from that child. And only when the diagnosis begins and counseling begins is she beginning to build up a relationship. Genetic chips and bacteria. I think here there's been some work that's been done, and then it was said, okay, 95% of testing here will bring about healing, and right. The chimera, once again. What exactly is it that you heard? Is it only being tested, or is it being implemented, or what is it? Genetic chips used for tuberculosis, antibiotics resistance, and that supposedly the whole process could be reduced in terms of the time required and to come up with results. Well, there are laboratory techniques, and for bacteria, I think this particular method or test has been applied for quite some time. I have a question for Ute Wannemann. I saw and noticed in our discussion that on the one hand, someone from the audience made clear the difference between the genetic testing, and on the other hand, diagnostics, that the two things are not the same. Yet we always seem to arrive at that point where people go into a clinic and are then confronted with a physician and are counseled, and we're always dealing with women who are the clients here. We had the comparison with the stock exchange world, on the other hand, where you have mainly men playing the stock exchange game, and on the other hand, we have the women going to medical clinics. I wouldn't reduce it down to biological gender. There are also women involved in genetic research. But we can maintain that, yes, the final decision in birth, especially when dealing with genetic syndromes, as I said, they are very rare, and where parents have the particular gene, and where then the birth of the child is a manifestation of a 50% chance of possibly in getting the disease that might be brought forward by that one gene. So, to the extent that women are still necessary for this whole process, then she's the one who finally, in the end, will have to make the decision. And even then, if at some later point in time the female uterus is no longer necessary, then things might change. Let me move on. PGD applied for extracorporeal fertilization. So in other words, women who have decided that they will be inseminated in a manner that takes place outside of their bodies. Of course, here you said everybody has to ask themselves, well, what is my own history? What is my potential for risks? What is my background? Does that mean then that possibly, quote-unquote, normal fertilization will be considered to be something that's much too risky and people will opt for something else? So maybe at some point people will say every woman should undergo PGD, prenatal genetic diagnostics, and not simply hop into bed and not think about some of the consequences. Well, it might be then the technological completion of the whole concept, but I'm sure it would be accompanied by counseling, namely what physician would you go to, and it would, yes, it would be bringing this model to completion, but whether that is how things will develop, I don't know. Well, the president of the physicians organization told me exactly that 3 months ago or 3 weeks ago, that after all, with animals, we've had this method applied for quite some time, and possibly we'll move in that direction for human beings because everything else is much too risky, and he said about 5 to 6 years. I mean, he is the president of the physicians' organization. Well, we saw in the 1970s there was also suddenly a fad to have a cesarean because cesarean supposedly was less risky than normal birth. So again, here we seem to have a certain trend in the offing. But there's somebody from the audience who'd like to ask a question. Yes, concerning the whole notion of responsibility, I wanted to say something. Mr. Losch talked about responsibility on the part of people who go to the physician's clinic, and then Ms. Mathis talked about physicians and researchers who are not disclosing and data and research. And so on the one hand, we have physicians not disclosing information. On the other hand, we have a neoliberal set up where the individual is responsible for everything. Maybe Maybe you need to get together, and as far as the other lady's concerned, there was talk about self-help groups. Now, these neoliberal individuals, are they the ones who need to be criticized, or do we criticize physicians, or what about the self-help groups? A question, basically, in terms of a general critique of social trends presently. I don't think we need to enhance our criticism vis-à-vis one particular group. There is a trend that goes in that direction of having the patient, the individual, the client take on more responsibility. And that's where I talked about self-eugenization, namely where the client takes on full responsibility. Now, with physicians and their specialty knowledge about human genetics, whether I have a more directed or an undirected counseling session, I think it's relevant because a physician could tell you this is what your situation is like, you shouldn't give birth. Or somebody can tell you what the different options are and what the possibilities are. And it's always the physician, of course, who is in possession of that specialty knowledge. But it is always the client who bears the responsibility, it seems very clear. And also, the client is, of course, afraid, or there is fear that's induced, but the client doesn't take on the responsibility herself out of her own motivation to take on that responsibility. I think it's the climate in society. Clients will go to a clinic, to a physician's office, and will want to give birth to as healthy a child as possible. And then it depends on the physician, how the physician presents the knowledge. There is the individual physician's bias, and there is a study on human geneticists and how they present information, where you can ask Down syndrome, is it good to have people in society that have the Down syndrome? So, in other words, it's the expectation on the part of the woman who goes for counseling, it's the physician, and it's the situation in our society. If the physician is well trained, then the physician will know that they should be non-directed in their counseling, but sometimes it's very heavy-handed that a physician might say, "I'm sure you won't want to give birth to this kind of a child." So physicians need to give all that information to clients. They're aware of that, and there have even been cases where physicians have been taken to court. They've been sued if they didn't present all the information. I think in this connection that it doesn't make sense to try and to look at the individual players in this overall scheme of things. I think it's important to see what the interrelatedness is of, on the one hand, research policy, which sponsors and funds very specific research, and here this is very much based on lobbying and groups, clinicians, the medical profession, and the particular research that is promoted there. This, I think, is where we have to level social criticism, and it is not only to be seen in the context of the ideology, but here we also have to look at what this is based on in terms of the information that's made available. And this is where the self-help groups come in. There are self-help groups that are extremely naive, and when you look at multiple sclerosis, MS, for example, no one really knows exactly what it is, and it's now being defined slowly. And there are self-help groups that just very naively grasp at every straw that is held out for them. And here we need to level some criticism, I believe. And we have to look at the structure of it all. And I believe that here there's a lot of work still cut out for us. I wanted to give an everyday example. In Heidelberg, for example, one example, just an everyday example. In Heidelberg, there is a counseling service for disabled women, and they also offer counseling for future mothers and fathers. And anyone possibly expecting the birth of a disabled child will go there. And it's about two or three per year, and the question is, well, where is everybody else? And it seems that women even don't get that far, that somewhere it stopped before they actually think about possibly giving birth to a disabled child. And we had here a situation with a vacancy in one of these consulting offices with the University of Heidelberg. And this was somebody who applied for the job, very committed and involved politically, but she was not taken for the job because she was seen as not being objective. I have a last issue I'd like to tackle with everyone on the panel. What is the reason why should we not say, okay, women subject themselves to PGD, why should she not have the possibility to decide on the color of the eyes of the child she is going to give birth to, and will not be overweight, and so on? Why shouldn't she take this opportunity to have a designer baby? Wouldn't this mean emancipation for women? So I'm being provocative. Well, I think there are different positions one can take on this. Why are we continuing in our critical position? I can tell you, I base my arguments on the following, namely, it's not that I simply loathe genetic engineering, rather, we have here an optimization and a perfectioning and an installation of an oppressive relationship in terms of certain kinds of people not being given birth to, and those who already are born. Are given a method for planning their lives that depends on a certain type of technology, and thirdly, that a very specific industry is able to make a good profit from all of this. That's my stance. Emancipation, I don't know how that comes in, because let me remind you, take a more global look at this. who is it that goes into reproduction clinics to get sperm? In the United States, we already have sperm banks where sperm is categorized. Even oocytes are categorized according to certain traits and features that the sperm donor has. And we also see here in this country that those who avail themselves of artificial insemination usually are people from the middle classes. It's still being financed by the statutory sickness funds in Germany, but at some point it'll be such that we'll also get sperm banks here. But when you look at the rest of the world, where you have people who don't even have basic health care, then 1984, Brave New World, where cloning of specific types was the scenario, possibly this will then take care of itself. So I don't think it is in any way tied to emancipation. And secondly, self-determination in a complex society like ours is something which is very far removed from the technologies that exist. And prenatal diagnostics, for example, as was described, already has distanced women from their own bodies, as you described. Only once they go into counseling are they really beginning to take hold of what is happening to them. So I think it is not in any way connected to the notion of emancipation. When you have certain genetic material, you will find at some point men will become superfluous, and then emancipation will come to the fore. Emancipation and the superfluousness of men, I don't understand that connection. Could you please explain? Well, it depends on how you define emancipation with respect to women. Well, but emancipation is not only linked to women. Well, but that's the way it's dealt with. That's the way it's dealt with, at least in the public realm. Emancipation is something that's defined by women in this society, in our society. I don't think I really get what you're saying. You said emancipation is being defined by women because they have the potential to select and make that decision as to the genetic material. And so they then will determine to what extent male fetuses will be produced. But on a worldwide scale, it is female fetuses that are aborted. I think I'm not talking about the present potential for selection. I'm talking about a way to come to grips with it. And genetic engineering, genetics is very able and to master that situation and thus strengthen the position of women. I can't agree with you, and it is not at all concerned with self-determination. And It's a fact, women, and worldwide, we see that it is female fetuses that are aborted worldwide. I think you simply have to look at some of the figures. You're talking about India? No, no, no. Those countries where these abortions are possible, we have the same situation. Okay, I think we can gather examples from all over the world. I didn't want to take the concept of emancipation into these fields. Rather, my provocation was to say if you could have a designer baby, then that might mean the individual woman is emancipated. And you were just now saying that no, if you subject yourself to the whole process, then you will be giving up your emancipatory possibilities right there. And that might be the crux. And I would think that that is how women are won over, because that is the way it is sold. It is sold to women as a way to get total health for themselves and their babies. And these tests, as was rightly said, are tests and not diagnostic means. There's another aspect I'd like to get back to, namely extracorporeal fertilization and PGD, and Ms. Matas said that even now the physicians' organization is increasingly saying yes, this is the tendency. At some point, all women will be choosing this mode of reproduction. Now, within reproduction technologies, we've seen that superovulation takes place, in other words, where supernumerary oocytes are generated. The woman is stimulated so that these oocytes are produced. Let me ask you, what is the risk here? Does that mean we then have more oocytes than fertilized oocytes? We'll have more embryos that we need, they can then be frozen and can be used for other purposes, and what will happen? Well, stem cell research, you know, there are denucleated oocytes that you require in high numbers to do the research. So what we have here in terms of supernumerary oocytes will not suffice. And in the third world, I'm sure there'll be clinics that will spring up, and women will be paid to offer their oocytes. So I think this is also something that's not really talked about. It's hushed up somewhat. I'm sure there'll be at some point oocyte tourism, right, similar to trade in human organs. In other words, the woman, as I said, had to be hyperstimulated, and when the oocyte is extracted, you require anesthesia. It's a medical intervention. It's not simple donating an oocyte, and on a voluntary basis, I'm sure women wouldn't do it, and not here. Let me give you some. When talking about fertilization tourism, and when mentioning that women have to go to Belgium and to have PGD performed, let me mention that it's about 50 couples that go into Belgium per year. And we have to remember that 50 couples, so it's a very small number, right? And there's a lot of hype about it, a lot of hype and hoopla. And when you think the numbers of people otherwise affected by diseases, and nothing is made of it. I'd like to draw this debate to a close. I'd like to get back to the designer baby, this notion of the ideal human being. It's similar to saying oxygen is not what the individual requires, but you now require ozone. And I'm sure that nature will take its course. And if you then see the environment and how the environment is polluted, then afterwards one tries to clean it up again. Very parallel developments. The personal identity of the unborn is something that we have overlooked somewhat. Mr. Lush, I'd like to address you directly. You talked about passing on responsibility. You talked about self-pathologizing and the particular mechanism that is involved here. It's important to recognize that mechanism in order to be able to critique it. And in the course of the debate, we heard that capital accumulation, capital implementation, and you talked about Wagemann and the possibilities. I think this is here we have an opportunity to enlighten people, to inform people, and even if the structure is such that things are not really moving at the moment, but here, because of that, the high potential that the individual has to make decisions, I think here we have a place where we can begin and to launch our criticism and also present information. Right, I can only support that. Ms. Wagemann talked about an artificial uterus. Let me ask you, do you think one can do without prenatal influences, psychological history of the mother, for example? Will we be able to do without that once you have an artificial uterus? I was just saying that research is going in that direction. There's still some hindrances and obstacles when you go in the direction of trying to create perfect human beings, then the obstacle is still mother. And I was referring to that, really, because she's an imponderable player in the whole equation. A lot is talked about, a lot is said about prenatal behavior of mothers and so on. And there are certain things that mothers must not do in that prenatal period. And all these things are just speculation. I wanted to simply point out that we have to look at what research is focusing on, and that the body of the woman and the fetus, that these two are being extremely and more separated. And this is being researched in one direction only, at least as far as I'm aware of it. Just coming to the close, I want to get back to the professor who talked about life being created outside of the female uterus, and she compared it to the igniting of the atom bomb. I'd like to get back to that. Yes, I talked about the author Joshua Lederberg, and he made this connection between the research and development that led to the atomic bomb and the research and development that led to procreation taking place outside of the female uterus. You wanted to ask something specific to that? That was not a closing remark, so I will now take this opportunity and ask, why do we not want a designer baby? We just got the explanation for it, for the simple reason that the human head and mind is not big enough. Back in elementary school, I remember we were taught a story. My brain is not big enough, but I remember that the story was such that if somebody had the power to determine the weather at whim, then, for example, harvests would no longer take place because you wouldn't get the right wind at the right time for pollination. And in other words, our brains are too small. We don't have all that knowledge and information, the capacity for to make the right decisions. And this gets back to responsibility. Who bears the responsibility? Can we really say that mothers, that parents bear the responsibility for the decisions that are made? External determination of self-determination is what somebody said. I mean, these are developments that are not new. Schopenhauer talked about it over 100 years ago. An individual can do whatever they wish, but they can't want what they do. And I remember somebody talking about something that happened in the 70s. A friend of mine got German measles during her pregnancy. This was in the 70s. And some of the sequela of that, what will an infection mean during a period of pregnancy? And the woman at the time said she, given the possible consequences, then would not want to give birth to that child. But she is still suffering from the decision she made at the time. So she is trying to deal with it in a very positive manner. But I think it's important to see how decisions will impact lives of people for many, many years, not just for a year, but possibly for the next 10, 20, 30 years. These decisions that we make will bear very grave consequences and have their impact felt. And I think this is what I am trying to say. It's not so much a question of responsibility that's borne by the individual, but to what extent is a society to empathize with those individuals who make those decisions. And then I think the images of disabled children that are shown to patients will then lose the impact. Prenatal diagnostics. Another case in point, there was a spina bifida, was one diagnosis that was made again for a friend, and it was then mentioned in this discussion here that possibly counseling could be enlarged and not only physicians be involved. And in this case here, the mother concerned, who got the diagnosis of spina bifida, she actually went to different professors and specialists in order to get help, other input. And they all behaved in the same way. They all said, you should just abort the child. I'm sure it was not as black and white as that. But she then said, I am now not going to follow the advice that they give me. She said she couldn't simply deal with this information anymore. She gave birth to the child, and the child is extremely intelligent, has a slightly enlarged head, and is a very vital child, extremely intelligent, and is really keeping them on their toes. And so that reminds me of something else, namely the iron content of spinach. And not only Popeye needs to suffer from this, but it was in the academic publications that one author copied from another author, and at the end, everybody copied from everybody else. And that's what these specialists did as well. They simply looked at the findings of the other specialist and then simply basically corroborated what the other specialists had said. Okay, thank you very much. Then the question of liability. And of course, one physician has to know what the other physician recommended because of this whole liability issue.
This idea that we have to get back to our roots, and either the future society will be more spiritual than this one, or we just won't have one. Okay, well, I think I'll leave it there as a final remark and say thank you to the panelists. I'd be pleased to see you back here at 4 p.m. when Ernst Klee will be talking about the great patience we have with those who commit crimes and the way the victims of those crimes are expected to suffer. Thank you.